Your microphones are live.
We're going to get started.
Good morning and welcome to the November 1st, 2011 San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors meeting. Would you please rise and join us for the flag salute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, thank you very much. Madam Clerk, changes to the agenda, please.
We have one change. It's an amended item on consent, item A1, the introduction of a proposed ordinance amending the county fee schedule for fiscal year 2012-13 and calendar year 2012 for probation, parks, golf course, and airports parking fee only. Recommend approval and instruct clerk to give notice of the hearing date set for November 22, 2011 at 9 a.m. Staff is recommending this item be amended by replacing pages 171 through 172, 173, and 175 to reflect all fee changes. The replacement pages are attached. Those are your changes.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we will move to our consent agenda. I have one request from the public to speak on consent. That would be Mike Brown. Mr. Brown?
Mike Brown representing CoLab. Item A2 is the set hearing for the consideration of the in lieu housing fee rates, and I realize that's coming in December for the hearing. But prefatory to that, in looking at this and looking at it around the state, there are 145 jurisdictions that have implemented this in some form out of the 450 cities and 58 counties. So it's not wildly popular. It's really a tax posing as a fee. You're taking money away from somebody who's building a market house, a market price house, and handing it to someone else. So it's really a redistribution tax. That being said, and when it comes back for the full hearing, I think it would be good to have the staff put it in context and talk about what it's accomplished, because, of course, not much is being built to impose this tax on. What are the real results, and what are they likely to be? And where does it sit with everything else? It's depending on the size of the market house, the fee is on a scale. But where does that stand in connection with the other fees and exactions you impose on market development? What about the costs for processing permits and so forth? What does all that add up to for the typical market house on a schedule, and what does that mean? And would it be good to have a change in policy given the state of the economy and the dismal housing market to change that? And I think, it's not just whether you're going to ooch the fees up a little or leave them the way they are, but where does this stand in the big picture? So we would hope when it comes back there's a very full discussion on that. Thank you.
Okay. No more requests to speak on consent agenda, so I will bring it back to my colleagues to see if they have items they'd like to comment on, beginning with Mr. Teixeira.
None, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham?
None, sir.
Mr. Gibson?
No, thank you.
And Mr. Patterson?
None this morning, Mr. Chair, and with that, I'll move approval of the consent calendar.
Second.
As amended.
As amended.
Okay.
Second.
As amended with, that's moved by, yes, Supervisor Patterson, second by Supervisor Meacham. Roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes, thank you. Okay, we are moving forward. If you have a request to speak on public comment, please get it in. We will begin the public comment period with Mike Wynn, followed by Gwen Taylor, please.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, supervisors. My name is Mike Wynn, and I'm a director in the Napomo Community Services District. I'm here first just to thank you for your support in your last meeting to encourage NCSD to take a lead in formation of a tax assessment district. We need a funding source, and I think you guys were very, very helpful. We appreciate that very much. We do have a water shortage. We are looking at solutions for that. And to that end, we have a public meeting, which will be held a week from tomorrow night. It's November 9th at 6:30 at the high school. You're all cordially welcome to come, listen, give us your best thoughts. But we have been listening to the experts. We've been listening to the public. And we're going to survey a large range of solutions and then try to explain why the pipeline from Santa Maria seems to be the most cost-effective, the fastest source that will actually have enough water to do us any good. So that will be at 6:30 at Napomo High School a week from tomorrow night. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Ms. Taylor, followed by Ben DeFada, please.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. The open, democratic transparency of county government is a myth. The people of Los Osos have and continue to ask for an open town hall meeting for those in the Prohibition Zone and those outside the assessment district that will be included in the groundwater basin management costs and plan. Costs for the retrofitting and out of the Prohibition Zone is going to come to those who do not even know this. The assessment or assumption by Supervisor Gibson that all the questions regarding the wastewater project have been asked and answered either by email or by phone is a fallacy. Why would anyone outside the Prohibition Zone contact a member of the sewer team if they did not have a clue as to their inclusion in the wastewater project? Why would they and how would they know who to contact and what questions to ask? How many know what effect the ISJ is going to have on costs to them, since the county has not divulged the overdrafting of the basin and the need for conservation due to saltwater intrusion, or the potential need for an additional source of water supply and additional costs to the people of Los Osos in total? Whether all the grants and with all the grants that are approximately being referred to, $300,000 of prepayment of the sewer project, a very small cost, for a town hall meeting must be made available to inform the public. That money is supposedly the $300,000 available now. It has been used, apparently, for other things than the sewer project itself. Therefore, a town hall meeting would be applicable to use this money. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. DeFada, followed by Bo Cooper.
Good morning, Chairman Hill, Boards, Sheriff, Public, Ben DeFada here from Gibson Bankrupt Village of Los Angeles, where the sewer saga still continues. Chairman Hill, you ever wonder why the citizens of this country, state, county, Los Osos are distrustful, frustrated, and weary of politicians and politics? Well, politicians have a habit of shading the truth, taking away the people's rights and tax their savings. They have worked hard for 50 or 60 years. Just like all government entities, they just charge it, steal it from people's paychecks before they even get to see their paycheck. Politicians think all we have to do is go out to the backyard and pick it off a money tree. Of course, our District 2 supervisor, Mr. Gibson, has a citrus farm, so he does have a money tree farm that produces money. At last Thursday's office hours, Mr. Gibson spoke to a few of his dreamer friends back and forth for about 15 minutes about saltwater intrusion and other things. When it was my turn to ask, my question was answered by John Waddell, and like in the Jerry Seinfeld comedy show, the favorite saying of the soup Nazi was, "Next," by Gibson. I was not allowed to have any dialogue like his cronies had with him previously. In that split second, I asked him how much did they figure the treatment plant was going to cost, and John Waddell blurted out $30 million plus. Then I asked, why do you have to spend $30 million for a treatment plant when the water is unfit for farmers to use on their crop fields, like neighbor farmer Barry Brennan said at last week's meeting before you all? I managed to mention that Aquafluids treatment plant costs less than $10 million, and you can drink the treated water that comes out of the pipe that comes out of the other end of the plant. Next thing I heard is, "Next." I left in disgust. You see, when Mr. Gibson is asked the hard questions, he doesn't want to talk about it. Chairman Hill and you other two, don't you find it highly suspicious that Mr. Gibson has something to hide? I never see any of you other four ever ask him, why aren't you building this project with a cheaper and better alternative collection system and a better alternative treatment project, a project that is $50 to $100 million cheaper, a project that would save several thousand property owners, renters, and businesses from having to move out of this little village that sits on a sand dune. These are questions you all should be asking. Instead, you're waiting for another $5 million flawed study that was asked to only look at gravity, a study that doesn't include a seismic study or an affordability study to boot. Instead, staff was told not to return emails and phone calls from alternative companies who put out time and resources to only be treated as outcasts. They were not even considered in the equation. Chairman Hill, you should be ashamed of his and Ogren's actions. He should not have been selected to pick what system Los Osos needs when we need him to be our representative to protect and serve the citizens of Los Osos, not his crony contractors and engineers. To do it right, Supervisor Gibson can't wear both hats by being the judge and jury. People with authority and power have an ego problem where they find it difficult to change course no matter how many people have to move out of town. He's right and everybody else is wrong. We 5-7 people who come here week after week to get you to use common sense to build us an affordable. Anyway, remember, Santa Claus is coming soon and he is looking to see who is naughty and who is nice.
Thank you, Ben. Mr. Cooper, followed by Joe Shacker, please.
Bo Cooper, Los Osos. Thank you, Ben. Also, I want to piggyback on a letter Ben had in the Tribune yesterday about the cost of the sewer. A lot of people don't know exactly what it is. We always complain, hey, it's going to cost us too much. People are starting to panic. People are starting to freak out. People are realizing they got their tax bill of $745 recently. They said, whoa. This is only the beginning. What's going to happen? We can't even afford this. I just want to give an overview of what's going on. For the last 6 years, we've been paying $225 a year on a tax bill. People scratch their heads. It's the first 218 assessment back from April 2004. I'll talk monthly numbers. That 225 averages $18 a month. For the last 6 years, we've been paying. Starting 2011, this year, for the next 4 years, is an additional $745. Which is the USDA loan for 40 years, which is $81 a month. So $81 a month for the next 4 years we'll be paying. Starting 2015, when the project actually gets going, for the next 10 years to 2025, you add $437 a year, which is the SRF loan for 30 years, which is $117 a month, plus rates and charges kick in, plus we pay for lateral another $50 a month for 10 years. So anyway, so from 2015 to 2025, we'll be paying an average of $268 a month per household, right, for the next 10 years. Then for the next 20 years, starting 2026, the 2004 assessment paid off, laterals paid off. So for the next 20 years, from 2026 to 2045, we'll be paying an average of $200 a month per household. Right? For the next 6 years after that, from 2046 to 2051, the SRF loan is finally paid off, at which time we're averaging $164 a month. Then the USDA loan is finally paid off, gets down to rates and charges. So for the next 40 years, basically we're going to be paying $268 for the next 10 years and then $200 for the next 20 years after that. Obviously, it's unaffordable. These are real numbers. These are the county's numbers. These are real numbers based on the USDA loan and then based on the SRF loan. Then rates and charges, lateral costs. These are real costs. I can't afford it. Most of us will be dead. Almost everybody I'm looking at and the people I know I work with we're all going to be gone by 40 years from now. But people, we need to be part of the passing parade of people saying, no, help our grandchildren, help our neighbors, help the people that are coming up. The sewer is just too expensive. Need to really examine it. I've said it before, I say again, we're not a bunch of crazy people who are talking to you. We're passionate because we're trying to defend our homes and our neighbors' homes. And please reconsider. It's just too expensive. That's a sufficient reason to halt the project and reconsider. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Shacker, followed by Al Barrow, please.
Good morning. Regarding last week's Board of Soup's discussion about the flooding in Oceano, at the Oceano Community Service District meeting the day after the Board of Soup's meeting, the Public Works representative provided more details on the plan to deal with the Meadow Creek Lagoon system. Much of the $375,000 for the pump and pipeline would go towards equipment rental and cost of the rental company's employees to run the equipment. Although it might help, the pump and pipeline solution will not solve the island flooding issue. It is inadequate, not feasible, and temporary. When your bathtub clogs up, you eventually have to clear the drain. You don't pump the water into the sink. Strand, Juanita, and other residences will surely come forward with complaints because of loud pumping noise and tearing up the streets for the pipes. Although we are all encouraged by having funds allocated for solving the flooding issue, let's not squander it. Let's step back and evaluate the pump and pipeline solution. Public Works did take a step towards helping the flooding on the island. After stating on Wednesday night that they couldn't clean the ditches on Aloha and Honolulu, the next day the ditches were cleaned out. We in the community thank you for that effort. However, that was only a baby step. The next step is to take the same desire and effort and direct it to partnering with state parks to allow the water from the ditches and streets on the island to flow into the lagoon. Since state parks has changed its theme from "we don't want to disturb Mother Nature" to "it's difficult dealing with all the regulatory agencies," let's team with them in creating a permanent solution. In addition to proposed emergency permits when needed, form a team to get a permit to perform maintenance on the lagoon. I've been told that might take 2 to 3 years and an EIR. It would probably take less time if driven by desire and effort from the team. So let's get started. Over 10 months have already been squandered. Thank you so much, and I'd like to just leave the text of my comment with all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Shacker. Mr. Barrow, followed by Richard Margetson, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low Income Housing. Your staff is proposing a gravity sewer. Gravity lines are straight lines that have a slight engineered slope, usually something like 8th to 16th of an inch per 100 feet. The laterals have a little bit steeper slope from the homes so that the solids can flow into the system and then down the gravity slope. If you look at the overhead, you'll see that I have a presentation of liquefaction hazards for the Loso sewer that was presented roughly 6 months ago. We have liquefaction is also commonly observed during earthquakes. It's a phenomenon where saturated sand lose their strength during an earthquake and become fluid-like and mobile. As a result, the ground may undergo large permanent displacements that can damage underground utilities and well-built surface structures. The type of displacement of major concern associated with liquefaction is lateral splitting because it involves displacement of large blocks of ground down gentle slopes or towards stream channels. So if you, I may have this again on me, please. What we have here...
You won't see it up above.
Just for a moment. We have this line, but because of the liquefaction, the line tends to go up like this because it's buoyant. So you lose that engineered slope, which makes it impossible for the sewer to function. Therefore, you have what's known as sewer overflows. Sanitary sewer overflows. And if I may go back to my presentation once more on the overhead. This is the map of the liquefaction in the county. You can see Los Osos in red. That's a high level of liquefaction with a high probability of earthquake during the life of the sewer. So you can see these are manholes that have been buoyed up by the earthquake in other places. I would just like to point out to you that you have not mitigated these risks, and they're very expensive to replace a sewer like this. Dig it up and replace it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Mr. Margetson, followed by Dr. C. Height, please.
Richard Margetson. First of all, I have to note or question who in the room is the concern of the board that this week we have two sheriff's deputies in the back of the room. I'll just leave it at that. I think we've addressed that issue enough, the stupidity of it. I handed each of you, or I passed out, a page from the Madawis Water Demand Analysis 2011 and Water Conservation Evaluation that was commissioned by the ISJ group, of which the county is a member, along with the three water purveyors in Los Osos. This page 19 has a pie chart on it, another piece of evidence in our earlier conclusion that when you establish the rates and charges ordinance, the county used the improper percentage of consumption for commercial. We tried to tell you. Staff didn't believe us. Board supervisors didn't believe us because you passed the ordinance. But since that time, actually, the best evidence that we've collected, and just for information, gentlemen, the lawsuit that was threatened is still in the works. We're just trying to make sure that it's an absolute slam dunk. And I have to say that Golden State is actually providing the best evidence proving this, because every brochure they put out on their new rate increases talk about commercial consumption way in excess of 10%. Your ordinance said it was 4%. This chart, though, commissioned by the purveyors with numbers from the purveyors, states that commercial consumption is 14.7%. And if you know anything about the prohibition zone, gentlemen, almost the entire commercial district is inside the prohibition zone. So, what happens if one category, when this, as we've heard, you will probably have to redo this at some point, it'll have to go out to another 218. Because if one category goes up in rates and charges, you have to put it out again. But I guess my biggest question is, how does Mr. Gibson now spin this to the commercial district that when this all plays out, their rates and charges, their rates and charges could be triple of what they are now. And that will be by law, gentlemen. Thank you.
Dr. Height, followed by Lindy Owen, please.
I have a video to start. Dr. C. Height, Los Osos World Community Workshop. I encourage the county to be proactive to protect wildlife and lifestyle of the coast. I'm continuing my theme of water war this Day of the Dead. There is a second wave headed for our shores that will clog power plant intakes, our harbor, our estuaries with debris. The broken dreams of a people, a confetti of crushed homes, industrial waste, cars, boats, is now our responsibility, a global responsibility. We can learn from the people of Japan. We can learn how they handle their debris for those who shelter in place, learning late the seriousness of Fukushima. Fukushima is the gift that keeps on giving. A people's tragedy is now our tragedy. They need to start planning ahead to offset screens for Diablo Canyon, for the Morro Bay power plant, for the power plants up and down the coast, because there's going to be ongoing debris. And this map of the tsunami wave is now a map of currents of debris that's coming our way, and there's going to be industrial pollution that's coming ashore. It's been an obvious tragedy what's happened in Japan. And the people that are going to be addressing this tragedy are the people that are in this room that are already putting their time in coastal cleanup, caring about the environment, caring about Los Osos. You know, it is the news that actually corresponded Diablo Canyon because of the earthquake faults with the Fukushima problem, because it was Mother Nature. We couldn't predict it. And here's some images of the debris that's coming. You might want to rethink the demonization of the people of Los Osos. It's going to take more than dedicated people picking up trash from our shores. It's going to take a flotilla. Do you imagine that absentee landlords, foreclosure banks, second home, vacation home buyers are going to be treading through the muck along the shores, cleaning a tsunami of debris? The people who conserve, who contribute to their community, are before you, and you will learn to appreciate them. Having a plan to deal with this flotsam of a tragedy is a community responsibility in absence of government responsibility. And so this is November 1st. Everyone knows that it's coming. They know that they have time, but there needs to be some plans in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Ms. Owen, followed by Eric Greening, please.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from the Prohibition Zone in Los Osos, where 5,000 homes are being asked to pay for an unnecessary antiquated gravity collection system and sewer at the cost of $200 million, money that could, if we actually directed our building of a sewer towards the less expensive and a phase system, we could be paying so much less, and we would have money that would actually keep our community afloat and be able to take care of future disasters and things that are coming. I wanted to acknowledge Dr. Height's presentation as the world we live in now. You don't go build sewers for a world that we lived in 50 years ago, which is what Pava Ogren and Mr. Gibson have taken on as our project for Los Osos. That is a project that was taken away from our CSD, which was elected by a majority to build a sewer outside of town and to change collection systems. And we didn't get that, so that's why we keep coming here. And maybe someday we'll come here to congratulate you for stepping in and changing it towards a safer design with a pressurized system. You've just saw Mr. Barrow's presentation. We are going to have an earthquake, and if this sewer is even built by then, it will be obsolete. Why would you build something that is not going to work in a scenario that we know is coming? I wanted to also talk about the some of the problems that are happening with these gravity sewers. You have a city fine coming up. It's $57,000 fine for four different raw sewage spills. Now, these are spills that damaged the environment, went into the creek, and they all come from gravity sewers, which is what the technology we're asking you to help us install in Los Osos. Change it from that design to a pressurized system, which would have treated spillage. This stuff would not be nearly as toxic as what you're being, you know, different areas are being penalized. The cost of taking care of those sewers is outrageous also. There's monthly cleanouts. There are maintenance costs. The pumping alone is incredible. I also quickly want to move to another issue that has caused some problems in Los Osos, and it's the drainage area off of Ravenna, and it's a huge amount of extra water that got diverted, and it's landing on private property and causing erosion problems that are just astoundingly awful. It's ruining a drainage, an area that used to collect water. It will now be going into the bay. And the Public Works came out and did a minor repair on it. Totally unacceptable. It has no rock for it to land on. So all they did was repair the drainage area with loose asphalt that is also going to wash away. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Greening.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm speaking to the position the county is taking relative to Occupy Slow. And I appreciate the understanding that the First Amendment rights will be honored from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. I want to remind everyone that there is nothing in the First Amendment that restricts the time of its applicability. And we have precedents such as curfew ordinances, which court cases have shown First Amendment activities, protected activities, have to be exempted or those ordinances get thrown out. So that's some of the background. And as you know, I can talk about the First Amendment all day. I've talked about it here before, but I'm going to talk about bowels because I know this isn't just a First Amendment issue. It's a health and sanitation issue. How hard would it be to get a porta potty out there? And I know the first thought would be, well, why should we pay for a porta potty for them? This isn't just for Occupy Slow. This is years overdue. Ever use the buses after hours, weekends, evenings when things are closed? The bus drivers have needed it for a long time. The bus passengers have needed it for a long time. This new situation has just brought it to a boil. But we need one there. This is a very unfriendly town for biological functions unless you have the money to go into a restaurant or a hotel, and sometimes they're closed. But I think there's a double standard at work here, because the official count of homeless people in this county, which is undoubtedly an underestimate, is 3,800. They all have bowels. They're moving them somewhere. It's just not across the street and in your face. It may be next to a creek. What we have relative to that situation is a 10-year plan to end homelessness. When it's visible across the street, and I'm not saying that the product of human biology is visible, just people visible, exercising their First Amendment rights, suddenly it becomes something that has to be dealt with immediately. Why not a 10-year plan to move the Occupy Slow? Why not an immediate plan to end homelessness? There are sanitary issues happening all over this county, out of sight, from people who have no roof to get under, who are out there night after night after night. And in the meantime, could we get a porta potty across the street for the bus drivers, the bus passengers, and other people who need it, including people who exercise their First Amendment rights? And the First Amendment right applies 24 hours a day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. That will conclude public comment, and we will get to our first hearing of the morning. Madam Clerk, would you be so kind as to introduce it, please?
That would be item C1, a hearing to consider a request to approve the Santa Margarita Drought Reliability Project Alternative, certify the final environmental impact report, and direct staff to develop water partnership agreements and a financing plan. This is the 5th District. Recommend approval.
Okay. Mr. Hutchison, before we go to you, Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and on the advice of legal counsel, because I own a couple of parcels in Santa Margarita, I'm going to recuse myself from this discussion.
Okay, thank you, sir. Mr. Hutchison, you tell me when you're ready, and we'll get to your presentation.
Certainly.
And go to the PowerPoint. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works. This is a hearing on the Santa Margarita Drought Reliability Project, also known as County Service Area 23. I have a short PowerPoint, somewhere under 100 slides.
We're going to have a talk with our Public Works Department again on their presentations.
He said it was under 100.
I know, but that he was saying it in a way that meant that, you know, he was painfully.
Make it sound like 99.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
So our topics and actions for the morning. We have a little bit of background on the project. We'll ask you to certify the final environmental impact report and approve the project alternative, and then talk somewhat about next steps, which include project partnering and introduction of the financing approach. In Santa Margarita, just very briefly, the county actually began providing water service in Santa Margarita as County Water Works District Number 6 in the mid-1940s. That date corresponds with a major fire that ravaged the community. We don't have any direct evidence that there's a connection, but it seems logical. Water Works 6 became County Service Area 23 in the late 1990s. County Service Area 23 covers the urban area of Santa Margarita. As it's defined in the general plan, that's about 300 acres. There's 532 meters serving a population of about 1,400 people. Communities currently supplied water by two active wells. They're shown on this slide as well number 4 in the upper left center and well number 3 on the right side. Well number 3 is in the Santa Margarita Sandstone Bedrock Formation, commonly known as the Deep Bedrock Well. Well number 4 is about 55 deep feet deep. It's drilled in a somewhat shallower alluvial aquifer. You see wells 3 and 4, wells 1 and 2 are in close proximity to well number 4. They tap the same alluvial aquifer at about the same depth, but they're shut down because they don't comply with modern well construction requirements. You can see from this graphic that the Nacimiento pipeline borders the community on the north. That's the northern yellow line. State water pipeline borders the community along its southern boundary. The 1987-1992 drought revealed the vulnerability of Santa Margarita's water supply. The board had actually declared a water supply emergency when the March rains of 1991 effectively rescued the community. In response to that situation, a new deep well, that was well 3, and a replacement for wells 1 and 2 were drilled. However, it's evident that the community's vulnerability to a prolonged drought has not been fully mitigated. Since at least 2004, the community, through the CSA 23 Advisory Committee, has been considering various options for addressing the water supply situation. In May of 2010, the Board of Supervisors directed staff to proceed with environmental review and Prop 218 assessments for funding a potential connection to state water and to increase water supply reliability for that system. So, notice of preparation for the draft EIR was released in July of 2010. The draft was completed and released for public comment in March of 2011. Comments were received and responded to by September 2011. The EIR that we prepared is a supplemental document. This graphic shows that it supplements the State Water Project Coastal Branch EIR from 1992, but draws heavily from the State Water EIR of 91, the county's Nacimiento Water Project EIR from 2003, also the Santa Margarita Ranch EIR from 2008. We pulled in technical information from the Santa Margarita Ranch constraints analysis done in 1993. Supplemental EIR contains analysis of the full suite of environmental impact areas. These match the format of the EIR in which it's based and also the 1991 EIR. Moving on to alternatives, it is a comprehensive document. However, it did begin with the alternatives analysis by rejecting three ideas that were originally considered. One was enlarging Salinas Dam. That was the city's project from the 1990s. Another was reclaiming wastewater, and since the community doesn't have a wastewater collection system, rejected. And a third, in a couple iterations, was joining the Atascadero Mutual Water Company, which lies to the north. That alternative has a number of technical and, shall we say, legal considerations that made it very difficult to follow through with. So the alternatives that are addressed in the EIR, in addition to the proposed project, of course, the no project alternative, which is to do nothing. The second was water conservation, a standalone, simply move to that mode when droughts come. Joining the Nacimiento project in one of three different ways. The first bullet is what was described in the Nacimiento EIR for the raw water alternative. Nacimiento water is not treated, so direct connection is not possible. That alternative would run a line up to southern Atascadero at about Santa Margarita Creek and connect into their system. The water would be wheeled through the Mutual Water Company's pipelines. There's consideration in the EIR of exchanging with the Santa Margarita Ranch for their groundwater, and also consideration of building a new water treatment plant in Santa Margarita, although with 500 connections, it was a very expensive proposition. Similarly, the groundwater alternatives came up with three different ones, a new well in the same formation as well number three. The school well is essentially the same. The geologic information shows that it and well three are in the same formation. And then thirdly, a new alluvial well was considered. EIR's general findings are a little bit different than we typically see with a development project just because of the purpose and focus. The EIR found that the proposed project is the environmentally superior alternative. Typically, we'll see with a large development project that the no project alternative is environmentally superior, not the case in this situation. The EIR points out that any alternative involving local groundwater, so that's the three groundwater alternatives and also the exchange with the ranch, have significant unavoidable adverse environmental effects. The no project itself would result in significant environmental effects, and growth-inducing impacts for all of the alternatives are adverse, but found to be not significant. We got comments from six different organizations and individuals that totaled about 113 altogether. And those are included and responded to in Chapter 10 of the EIR that was distributed to your board previously. Looking at the project itself, in working with the advisory committee, they and we felt it was advisory to define our terms carefully. So we, in those meetings, defined drought reliability as water to meet the needs of the community during periods of low rainfall, essentially drought water, as opposed to supplemental water, which is a permanent connection that is available every year to be used for whatever community need there might be. So the project itself is constructing a state water turnout. We'll look at the details of that in a moment. And then it establishes a program which would consist of a 5-acre-foot per year allocation of state water along with a 5-acre-foot drought buffer and develop partner agreements that would supply the community with up to 80 acre-feet of water during a drought year. In non-emergency years, all of Santa Margarita's 5 acre feet would flow to the partner. And then in emergency years, the partner would dedicate 80 acre feet of state water to Santa Margarita. The partner would retain 10% of the water flowing to it as payment for their involvement. A program would establish what we call a water ledger, essentially a checkbook or a bank account record that would keep track of how much water is flowing to the partners, what's been withdrawn by CSA 23, and where the 10% increment ended up eventually. From a physical perspective, the turnout is a simple new connection to the state water pipeline. We saw on the previous slide that the line runs adjacent to the community on the south side or east side. That little circle there is in the northeast corner of the community, close to Highway 58. This graphic is in the EIR. It shows that we have about 30 feet of pipeline to construct, a connection building, and a state water turnout, all the valves and piping and pressure-reducing equipment in that turnout. So physically, physical impacts, very small, all of them are occurring in areas that were previously disturbed by our own well number 3, our own pump buildings, and the construction of the state water pipe. The project partnering is a little bit more complex. It would come into play only when the board declares a water supply emergency pursuant to the water code. So it does take board action in order for water to flow back to Santa Margarita. Any project partner has to be a state water contractor and has to have access to an adequate alternate supply when water is actually flowing to Santa Margarita. The program would operate like a bank, so deficits would be allowed. That would be a part of the negotiations with any partner. Again, the project partner retains 10%. We should point out that agreements could involve more than one partner, and also before they're finalized could involve other costs and conditions. The project partnering works in part because San Luis Obispo County has an unallocated reserve of 15,273 acre-feet of water, which is available for use. We also know that during drought conditions, additional capacity would likely be available in the pipeline above Santa Margarita because of reduced deliveries to Central Coast Water Authority, that's Santa Barbara County. They have a very small unallocated reserve, so typically when state water deliveries are reduced, there's room in the pipe for other or San Luis Obispo County water. We know that the state water pipeline has more capacity above the Cuesta grade than below, so even in a full delivery year, there's capacity available in the system to Santa Margarita. And we know that the treatment plant at Polonio Pass has excess treatment capacity, about 4 acre-feet per month, I believe, something like that. So in project partnering, we have a couple of examples. One of them, if the partner were to be Shandon or another upstream user, Santa Margarita CSA 23 would pay for 5 acre-feet of water per year. That water would be used by Shandon in lieu of their local groundwater. And then in a drought year, Shandon would pump groundwater, and 80 acre-feet of state water would flow down the pipe to Santa Margarita. However, we know that Shandon is moving towards making the physical connection to state water in order to utilize it, not necessarily share it. And there is some indication that they may not be interested in the partnering program, at least as a full partner. So a second example is Flood Control Zone 3. That's the Lopez Water Project in the South County. Very similar kind of situation. Margarita would pay for that 5 acre-feet. That would be used by those entities in lieu of Lopez water, so the water would be stored in Lopez Lake. And then in drought years, Zone 3 would shift over to Lopez water stored behind the lake, and Santa Margarita would take up to 8 acre-feet of water. Zone 3 has already endorsed a similar program. It was a 250-acre-foot storage allocation in Lopez Lake as part of a drought reliability project for other state water contractors in Santa Barbara County. That program was not implemented because we had a good winter. This concept of partnering with CSA 23 was already introduced to Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting in September, and they will take up the issue again for discussion this month, along about the 17th of November. A third example is a bit more complex, but it's partnering with the County Operations Center. That center has a state water allocation of 425 acre-feet and uses about 50 acre-feet, leaving 375, a portion of which we exchange with the California Men's Colony for sewer treatment at their plant. And then there's a further exchange where reclaimed wastewater is used to irrigate the Dairy Creek Golf Course. So in a water supply emergency, it's possible for the board to modify that agreement on a year-by-year basis, perhaps, and use some of that unallocated or unused 375 acre-feet to assist Santa Margarita at up to 80 acre feet. The advantage of this approach, by the way, it's actually fully under the control of the board, so the partner with Santa Margarita would actually be the flood control district rather than a different entity. These are just examples of the kind of partnering agreements that need to take place, again, before the project is fully finalized. In the area of financing, our department engineers have determined that the preliminary cost estimates, that the capital cost of the state water turnout is about $600,000, and there's a one-time buy-in cost of about $15,000. We estimate that of the USDA grant currently being used for new water lines and water tank in the community, nearly $250,000 would be available from that, leaving about $373,500 to be financed through the USDA loan program. That works out for 5 acre feet, about $7,000 a year, or $58 per property owner, which is a monthly equivalent of somewhat less than $5. Again, these are preliminary estimates. Our financing plan would be that there would be a 218 vote among the property owners, as opposed to a rates and charges, which is a protest vote. This would ensure that each property owner receives a ballot. And that vote, we believe, would function not only as a decision on the project, but also a referendum or a decision on the connection to state water in the first place. Moving on to recommendations, staff recommendation for today is to approve the Santa Margarita Drought Reliability Project alternative, that being the 5 acre foot allocation with the state water connection and the program to manage the partnering agreements for that 5 acre feet, to certify the final environmental impact report. The findings for that are in your staff report. And then finally, to direct staff to move ahead with developing draft water partnership agreements and finalizing the financing plan, bringing that back to your board for setting the 218 election. And that concludes the presentation on this item.
Okay. Just under 100 pages. Mr. Patterson, question.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Hill. Mr. Hutchinson, just a quick question regarding our next steps, which is the finalizing of the state water partnerships and then the financing plan and the 218 vote. Do you have a timeline on that, an estimated timeline?
I believe our timeline at this is working on partnerships through the remainder of this year and 218 early next year, January, February, back to the board. And, of course, there's a 45-day period during which ballots are out.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you speak, Mr. Hutchinson, briefly to how 80 acre feet in an emergency year was the determined amount of water?
Our department engineers looked at the amount of water used in the community over the past few years, which, like most of our communities on a per capita basis, is down slightly due to modern plumbing systems, calculated the split between indoor and outdoor use, and then made some engineering best judgment calls about worst-case analysis, and came to the number of 80 acre feet as being able to take us through the worst summer situation that we believe we could face in a series of dry years. The 1987-92 drought was used as a scenario development case to look at numbers used, putting in the more recent use numbers and population numbers. So they're fairly confident that 80 acre feet with a robust conservation program would carry the community through the worst case situation.
And for instance, prohibiting outdoor water use for landscaping and things like that. I mean,
yeah,
fairly draconian reductions.
Right.
And then as you approach developing partnerships here, have you thought about how many years we might be in an emergency and how much water? I mean, that speaks to what kind of partner you're looking for and what kind of capacity they have to sustain. I mean, one serious summer where 80 acre feet is going to be needed is serious enough, but I guess I envision the possibility of longer times, perhaps less than 80 acre feet. Have you based on your experiences in the late '80s, early '90s, gotten a sort of handle on what we're going to need there?
I think really what that comes down to is if you have multiple options, looking at the partner that is best positioned with their other sources to carry themselves through a drought period, so we don't get into a sort of a staring contest in the second or third year,
right,
when water supplies might be shorter than the partner counted on. So again, the three that we mentioned are solid opportunities with good backup supplies. They're close to home. We understand their full water situation. We understand how their boards work and how how well they apply water conservation, how they approach these things.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. With that, I will open up to the public. We have a few requests to speak. We'll start with George Sullivan, and we'll go to Jeff Edwards after that, please. Mr. Sullivan?
Good morning, members of the board and chair.
Good morning.
And the general public out there in TV land. I want to excuse my posture. I found out upgrading a toilet and taking the old heavy one out was they were designed to sit on, not to carry. And I followed up by planting an orchard the next day, so I should be laying down on my back, but I need to say this today. I'm not here to support the certification of the EIR for various reasons, and I believe that being staff was allowed to give a little history, I'm entitled to do the same. In 1889, when the town was subdivided, it was subdivided in 25-foot lots, and everybody had their own well, they had their own septic tanks. And as one would guess in time, that became a problem because of the spacing between wells and septic tanks. So in in the mid-40s, Supervisor John Ruskovich worked for the community of Santa Margarita to get a connection to the Salinas Dam, which was put in during a wartime effort about 9 months. And with that, a bond for $67,000, I believe, was floated in 1945. You know, that's a lot of money. And it was a very pointed effort to provide quality water for Santa Margarita. Quantity, it was never a problem. So that ripened into 200 acre feet permit 7253 of the Salinas Reservoir, known as Santa Margarita Lake, of which the state has informed me that we no longer have entitlement to that because due to a lack of diligence in part of the county of San Luis Obispo, that permit was canceled. So less than 10 years later, I find myself as a private citizen defending our entitlement to the reservoir and the fact that we have unexplored areas that could provide local water rather than cause another additional expense to the community on imported water. I want to hand this to County Council. That's the newspaper article with regards to condemned wells in 1947. So I just don't believe that we have done due diligence and served the public well by researching as well and drilling test holes and looking at our local resources. Connecting to the state water supply is it makes absolutely no sense for 500 customers circled by a 14,000 acre ranch. You would think we could work things out with our neighbors. Conservation, which we have, by the way, we use less than we ever have, and water, that is. And this process is more about creating staff jobs, in my opinion, than providing a service to the community, because we have already paid for that water for over 50 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan, and hope you get some rest and feel better. Mr. Edwards, followed by Michael Wynn.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Good morning, board members. My name is Jeff Edwards. I'm a 35-year county resident. The matter before you is drought reliability or buffer for the community of Santa Margarita. It's more than ironic that less than two short years ago, the county had the opportunity to secure sufficient water for the community of Santa Margarita at little or no cost. During consideration of the Santa Margarita Ranch, Supervisor Patterson you could have led the discussion and crafted a deal to get a new community well sited out of that deal, obviating the need for today's action. Instead, Mr. Patterson and Supervisor Gibson did everything you could to kill that cluster project, that ag cluster project. And you may still be working to kill that project, I'm not really sure. But suffice it to say that Supervisor Patterson and Gibson pressed on in spite of the primary message coming from the community of Santa Margarita, and that was approve the project, but secure as much infrastructure benefits as possible. Exact a community well in the deal. But no, instead the supervisors at the time listened to voices outside of the community, including those like the League of Women Voters and others, to stop the project at any cost. Now Santa Margarita is being asked to go for an engineering intensive make work project for Public Works. A pattern is developing. And it doesn't matter if you're in Los Osos, Oceana, or Santa Margarita, Public Works is consistently pushing unnecessary, high, soft-cost, USDA-funded projects. Got to wonder why. The state water connection may not be grant eligible, so what? So what? To discount the deep water well alternative because it appears to have unavoidable adverse environmental effects is bordering on the absurd. A new deep well in the community, whether or not it's grant eligible, is still the best option for the community. Why wouldn't you pursue that to the nth degree? In combination with conservation, this new deep well could quite likely satisfy all the needs of the community. But no, you're not hearing about that. And long-term, a concern I would have is the conversion of drought reliability to permanent supplemental water for the community, and I don't think they're interested in that. So the whole thing's a little amusing, but I would encourage you to reject this concept. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Mr. Wynn, followed by Eric Greening, please.
Good morning again, Chairman Hill, Supervisors. My name is Mike Wynn, and I'm speaking now as Chair of your Water Resources Advisory Committee. I do want to report to you that your staff made full presentations to the RAC. Our interests, of course, are quite focused on water and return flows. We did not get into a number of other issues that a number of our members are quite personally interested in and may speak to that, but we stayed focused. This seems to be a modest and workable project with a very limited goal to help a community that, like much of us in the area, do suffer from droughts periodically. The RAC took no action to endorse or to oppose this. We saw no negative impacts as far as the EIR for water was concerned, but I'm not speaking for them then when I say, from a personal level, I would urge you to certify the EIR and to help move ahead with the project of finding good partners and the finance program that will make this possible. As you do so, I have a couple of small questions. They're just sort of in the back of my mind. I wonder if 5 acre feet a year is quite enough. I realize if you save more, it costs more, and that's a greater burden on the community. So I'm not trying to add to the burden if it's avoidable. But how does the accumulation of 5 acre feet over time match up with the historic drought pattern that we have in the area? And does that seem to be sized appropriately? Maybe staff can address that. That's my only real question. And if I'm not asking that you go out into some 100-year drought, or some extreme scenario. What are the most common drought periods? How much water would be needed in those types of situations? And then is 5 acre feet a year enough to address it? Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Mr. Greening, please.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I served on the subcommittee of the RAC that looked at this. I was what you might call the state water skeptic of the subcommittee, and I approved of our work to the extent that it contained language that was not a recommendation to take state water, but simply said, if that decision is made, here are some of our concerns and issues. First question I have is, in an extreme drought, obviously, state water deliveries themselves are percentages of, and sometimes small percentages of, full entitlement. So would the 80 acre feet from the partner be the full 80 acre feet, or would it be a corresponding percentage of? And if not, why not, since it's being transmitted through the coastal branch governed by the Central Coast Water Authority? I think I agree with some of the people who say other options have not been adequately fleshed out. One that I'm not authorized to pursue in any official way. I'm just a guy that can have conversations with people, and I had some conversations with people involved with the school district. It occurred to me that they have a huge amount of excess turf at the Santa Margarita Elementary School that, as an educational institution, if they just kept the turf that's used and xeriscaped the rest, and the community, the CSA, were to pay them for the water that could be saved by doing this for the greater productivity of the well or whatever, the community would benefit and the school district would benefit in their operational budget. And most of the reactions I got would be that it would be sort of a complicated thing and that there would probably be problems with it and issues with it. I can't help but thinking that if it were the county opening this conversation rather than just a person, rather than just a citizen, perhaps a way would be found. In any event, I believe that there's an educational mission and that we have to start changing our ways. The most important teaching that kids notice is teaching by example. And if all of our schools are going to continue to be vast areas of unused turf, there are some very bad lessons there. And I'm also wondering, would the school be letting the turf die in a drought situation where everyone else had to stop doing their outdoor watering? Anyway, a lot of sort of collateral questions, but I'm on board to the extent with our report, to the extent that it's not an endorsement of state water. I personally don't endorse it. It has too many systemic flaws all the way to the Clifton Court Forebay and beyond, especially with rising sea level and climate change. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. And that will close it to public comment, and we'll bring it back to the board for discussion or questions, Mr. Patterson.
Well, I would like staff to have the opportunity to answer any of the questions that are raised. And if I don't see any questions from my colleagues, then I'll move forward with an action. But Mr. Hutchinson, were there any of the questions raised that you would like to address? I know Mr. Nguyen was curious about the 5-acre feet, and actually, you know, it takes 15 years to accumulate, actually 16 to accumulate the 80-acre feet at 5-acre feet per year, and there was a discussion about the drought cycle, and you did explain to Supervisor Gibson how you staff arrived at the 80-acre feet, and again, it's just an emergency drought reserve, basically, but would you mind attempting to address that question again?
I'll do my best. As we wrote the EIR and reviewed all of the work that our technical experts and the staff prepared, and I should mention, as well as, believe it or not, the 27 groundwater reports that have been done for Santa Margarita over the years, 9 of which appear to be very comprehensive, we look at those numbers, ask those same questions. When it comes to calculating how much water they'll need in a drought, was fairly straightforward. trying to figure out when the next drought will be and how long it will be is not as straightforward. But what I saw was careful consideration of historic weather patterns in Santa Margarita. We have data going back, and at least in one gauge, to the turn of the last century. So there's very good information about the rainfall patterns in that area. We can say that the last drought ended in 1992, which was 19 years ago. So if we'd had the program, the bank would be full and the town would be in good shape. That pattern seems to match what we see historically in droughts and gaps in betweens. And then, of course, you learn all about how to define a drought and not define a drought. So it really is the 5-acre feat comes from looking at the historical record with a little bit of conservative approach because of concerns about potential climate change and what that might mean for the Central Coast. Really, the difficulty is that at 5-acre feet, it's $5 a month, which doesn't seem like much. And I think the RAC pointed out, you know, that's a very modest amount of money. You could double your security, so to speak, with, again, a very small amount of money. But you have to make a decision as to where you're going to draw that line. And, of course, from the environmental side, we had concerns about growth inducement and maybe a little bit getting a little lax and cautious or not careful with conservation and those things. It does appear that when you look at the pattern of droughts, that 5-acre feet is the number that works, matches well with generating the 80-acre feet over time, being a little bit conservative. I think it's coincidental that at this point, if we take ourselves back to 1992, it shows that conservative approach. But I'm not going to say that we're going to have a drought every 20 years on the button. So the 5-acre feet really is based on historic record of droughts and how long it takes to accumulate 80-acre feet and whether that number balances out over time, given the historical record with a little bit of a conservative approach on top of it, just to be sure. I could respond to Mr. Greening's comments about state water. We're certainly aware of all the issues with that system. I did on one slide point out this unallocated reserve that San Luis Obispo County has. We are probably unique in the state in that, so that when we see the state water project, we'll predict a delivery of some pretty low numbers. San Luis Obispo County is at 100% to our contractors when state water is well down into the low 20% range. I think this project then is an attempt or a proposal to take advantage of that situation in a way and put that water to use in a way that's economically acceptable to a community and also avoids some of the concerns that the community has expressed, some members, about growth inducement, their relationship with the land surrounding them. There was talk about the school well. We certainly looked at that. That is another deep well, not far from well number 3. It's in the Santa Margarita Sandstone. We have concerns about, how shall you say, betting the farm on a bedrock well. It's conceivable that those wells could produce in the neighborhood of 80 acre feet a year. That seems to be what well number 3 is capable of on a regular basis, and do that for many years. But many bedrock wells around the country at a certain point simply stop producing water. They're not nearly as predictable as the traditional well in the alluvial aquifer. We did look at other aquifer wells in that area around Santa Margarita, but the prediction is that if well number 4 is having production problems, then any well in that same aquifer or the adjacent Trout Creek would be in the same weather conditions, very similar groundwater situations. I would mention that the aquifer, as we refer to it in Santa Margarita, is 50 feet deep to the bottom of the aquifer. And that gives our water planners a great deal of pause.
Right. You mentioned some of the unique situations that the community of Santa Margarita is facing. I won't comment on Mr. Edwards' comments relative to the ranch. We did have extensive discussions with them over the years, and they really weren't interested in being a water supply for the community. In fact, they've stated that they might actually intensify their use of the groundwater along that Santa Margarita Creek and the alluvium. and that could adversely impact the community wells. Santa Margarita is unique in that it's surrounded by the Santa Margarita Ranch, and it has two drainages through town and one creek alongside of town, so it really limits the opportunity to drill additional wells. You're either in the alluvium or you're close proximity to drainage areas, which potentially impact community wells as well. And we did have extensive conversations over the years with the school district. This opportunity, there are supporters in the community and there are opponents in the community. The CSA felt that we should at least give the community an opportunity to decide how they wanted to manage their water supply through County Public Works. And this is doing just that. And I want to thank Public Works for the years of engagement with the community on coming up with a drought reliability solution. And we'll take it to the community and let them decide. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll move staff's recommendation to approve the Santa Margarita Drought Reliability Project Alternative, certify the final EIR impact report and adopt the associated findings, and direct staff to develop water partnership agreements and a financing plan for board consideration.
Second. And if I might, Mr. Chair, just speaking to the motion, which obviously I think it's obvious that I support it, Mr. Wynn's comment that this is a modest proposal to ensure reliability of the definitively important resource. I think that while it's modest in size, actually the analysis that Public Works has done is quite remarkable and is actually a pretty good test case for things that are going to have to happen elsewhere in this county. We have a variety of water resources. They are of variable scope and capacity and reliability. And as we get into the squeeze of providing water to our all the residents of community that depend on things that the county controls, we're going to have to do some very careful thinking and some very careful engineering analysis. And I think this, in a small scale, has really opened up the nature of the discussion. So, okay.
Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes. We will take a 15-minute break and come back.
Approve the SSMP for all county facilities in May 2010. We did bring a presentation to your board in April this year addressing the sanitary sewer system breach that we had on March 30th, 2011, and the board directed us to prepare the audit and bring it back, this information back to your board. Today's item will cover, as I mentioned, these two issues, the SSMP audit and the collection system, and several elements associated with this regarding recommendations of the audit and some items we recommend to be due and will be doing on the collection system itself. The sewer system audit is a requirement of the sanitary sewer management program as required by the State Water Resources Control Board. The purpose of the SSMP is really to assure that agencies who have sewer systems manage, operate, and maintain those systems to minimize any overflows. This protects the public health, the environment, and the safety, as well as providing assure that there's a contact communication chain of information to notify spill responders and associated agencies and efforts. The SSMP that the board approved last year covers all the county's wastewater systems, which include the operations center, an Apomo pipeline that we operate, the Oak Shores collection system, and the County Service Area 18 Country Club Wastewater Collection System. The practical applicability and the importance of the SSMP was illustrated when we did have the breach earlier this year. Operation of that plan included a procedural memorandum, which the Public Works Department operates by, which requires communications. It requires regulatory notifications. Those are issues required in the SSMP. These do reduce the risk of sanitary sewer overflows, although the Oak Shores issue was a little bit different because that is a pipeline under the lake as compared to probably 90% of your sanitary sewer issues are with pipelines in the street that surface through manholes and discharge. So it's a little bit different, but the format is the same. And one of the important results, we determined that there were some necessary improvements with the SSMP, and that includes beyond the contact with regulatory agencies, creation of advisory agency notifications to let other people know what was going on for consistency and communications. And I'll talk about that briefly in just a moment. The audit summarized the overall audit. Depending on how you actually look at the audit requirements, there's mandatory audit requirements. Depending sort of on the subjectivity or objectivity of those requirements, you can interpret those a lot of different ways. And I just say that because as we first looked through it, we prepared the SSMP to abide by and to conform to the regulations. When we did the audit, it was apparent that we did comply with the requirements of the SSMP. And to illustrate that, or one summary item of that, is that the chart shows you that we had in the last 6 years, we had one overflow of 25 gallons of wastewater in the county, in all county facilities, compared to the other systems in the county, which are not county operated. We had approximately 84 overflow events recorded. And those are recorded through the health department. So this is really a summary of that information. We did not have any regulatory failures, and you don't see the sanitary sewer overflow on here from the Nacimiento event in March because that was not an overflow, it was a breach. So it's a little bit different categorization, but suffice it to say that we regulatorily meet all of the requirements of the SSMP. That doesn't preclude that we reevaluated it, and there's some things that we can make it better, and I'll talk about those in just a moment. The recommendations that came out of the audit are to make the recommendations I'll talk about in a minute and return back to the board in spring 2012 to have the revision approved. It's due to be approved, I believe, in May 2012 as the two-year cycle for an audit is required by the water resources regulations. A couple of the items that the audit recognized and recommended was that we update the organizational charts to include the State Department of Health Service and include environmental health in the communication chain that we do operate in under such an event. And also, as I mentioned, to include an advisory communication chart with phone numbers and details that we would keep everybody in the loop depending on where the incident may have occurred. The advisory notifications, how we would make those, is actually detailed in a, as I mentioned just a moment ago, in the department procedural memorandum that basically says if you have a spill, here's how it's categorized, here's what you do next, here's who you call, here's when you call them. All those specific issues are outlined in department procedural memorandum. The advisory notifications that we are going to be incorporating include quite a few at Oak Shores. I believe there's 18 agencies at Oak Shores. And the reason, which may be obvious or not, is because that sewer collection system is under the lake. Any type of a breach could end up into the lake, and it could affect the water supply users all around the lake. So that's why you see quite a number of agencies there. Likewise, the Country Club and the New Galaxy Park systems We would notify adjacent agencies or affected agencies. The county operations center is all county, so we would do that just as a normal matter of course. Switching now to the CSA Oak Shores wastewater system issues, just briefly, the background, there's approximately 2 miles of sewer line and laterals, collection systems, cleanouts that are below the Nacimiento high water elevation. A major portion of those lines are below the, I would say, average elevation of water level. When the lake is very, very low, the main collection system is still completely below the lake water level. And as the pictures here, you can kind of make out those pipes that are on the ground. Those are exposed because of lakeshore erosion, because of wave action and other issues over the last approximately 60 years that these have been in existence. This exposure of these joints at several locations and erosion creates a continuing breach opportunity for damage and leaking or inflow into the pipeline. One of the recommendations in the report is to do a risk assessment study of the interceptor system. We identified this a couple of years ago and budgeted a portion of money to be able to address this. It was supplemented this last year, and we have approximately $60,000 now in the CSA 7A budget. We believe this will be adequate to be able to do this assessment. In a sense, we want to use the information that was contained in this breach incident we had this last March, because previously we hadn't identified that the risk assessment would approach or would evaluate the entire water purveyor system of an area like Lake Nacimiento. So I think this will become a very comprehensive issue, and there will be a lot of items in there that we probably wouldn't have identified or maybe had a perception about before this breach that we had this last March. We anticipate that this will be completed in this next summer. And the intent of that, as I mentioned, is to really identify the quantity and the specific risks of the system for infiltration, exfiltration, leaks, breaches, breaks, attachments, boats, more erosion, that type of thing. And we want that to identify costs and recommended improvements to reduce those risks to the extent that we can. Just to kind of quantify this maybe a little bit in perspective, we did do an interceptor relocation study several years ago, and the approximate cost of taking and replacing the interceptor from below the lake to outside of the lake water was in the range of about $8 million. That was a very conceptual study that just dealt with moving that pipeline out of the lake and up into the normal area that you would have under the streets, and required a lot of pumping systems, that type of thing. So that's not something that we'll be addressing right now. It's a very large ticket item, as I just mentioned. Getting back to what we currently know, we did identify what we could tell were needed improvements fairly quickly or in the short-term period as a result of the breach that we had in March. And on this list, you will see the preliminary cost estimates for replacing pipelines, which is the forest mains, laterals, cleanouts, that type of thing, and cover up some exposed main lines where we can to protect those a little bit better. We have manholes that have been exposed that we have sealed up, and do a forest main integrity test to actually test the forest mains to make sure that they are integral too, and we don't have erosion or joint leakage for those. That was one item that happened as a result of the spill and the breach in March, this last March. This $1.178 million that we have summarized preliminarily at this time, there is no funding at all for any of this work in the CSA 7A budget. And we anticipate that as a result of the risk assessment and our further work on this, we will come back to the board with a budget plan to attempt to address this. The next steps that we will be working toward is we're asking today for the board to approve directing staff to final the audit report. We will prepare the risk assessment, which I mentioned. We will develop a capital improvement program and attempt to identify funding options that we can to remediate this problem to the best that we can. So the recommended actions today you have before you, and as well as directing staff to do other work as you might see fit. And that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Benedict. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dean. Good report. I guess one question on page 5 on the risk assessment study. To what extent will this study include? I guess when we if you look at the prior pages and all the different agencies that will be notified if something happens, do we do an assessment to see what risk is to them, or is it the immediate area?
Well, that's why I mentioned I couldn't spit it out at the time that it was the benefit we can take from the breach that we had is how pervasive this issue has become and will become. Before we had this incident, we've had minor breaches before. We knew they were flowing into the pipe. We had a negative suction, if you will, and so we weren't alarmed that we had leakage into the lake. Now, at that time, the lake wasn't used as any significant water source as Nacimiento. We didn't have much focus and attention on it. So at this point, our focus is not really going to be toward the impact of those agencies. It's more toward we have this unusual situation where a sewer under a lake body, and what are the risks that we could actually have an exfiltration of sewerage into the lake? And that's going to be our focus. The majority we've seen is into the pipe, and we want to make sure that we confirm from objective source that that is the major eventuality that we would see, not something vastly contaminating of the lake itself.
And then going over to the needed improvements, the $1.178 million, you're going to come back with a funding plan. But does this funding, is this all coming from the county, or is this assessed to that area, the CSA area?
Well, currently CSA 7A pays its own way.
Okay.
Through its own funding. I will tell you, I believe something around the range of $15,000 to $30,000 a year we have budgeted to do sewer lateral repairs. We can only do those when the lake is down. So anything beyond what we do would be an assessment. And as I mentioned about the replacement of the interceptor, that's a tremendous amount of money. We cannot do, if we had $1.1 million, we couldn't go out and do these today because most of this is all covered up.
And then I guess the other question is in regard to the funding, is there an opportunity to do a bond through that area?
We will investigate grant issue opportunities. And as your board may be aware before, when you have violations, it seems like it's easier to get grant money, which is a terrible way for me as a manager to even think. But that's the reality of the way things happen. We'll be checking for grant availability, for assessment options, and any other funding opportunities we can, and bring those alternatives back to the board.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, I mean, Supervisor Meacham, I guess as Mr. Benedict said, it's an unusual situation to have a sewer below water in a lake. It's not only a lake, it's a drinking water supply. And without being alarmist about it, this seems like something we need to work hard to correct. And I'm again, I don't want to catastrophize the whole thing, but should we have a catastrophic failure some part of this system that does exfiltrate into the lake, you know, what is our responsibility to other users of the lake water? What is our means of paying for interim fixes on this? You know, I think that the whole question of who pays for this is hugely important. I don't know how many connections are there in CSA 7A.
We have a potential for about 850.
So, okay, I was trying to do the math. It's not a $5 a month fix like Santa Margarita drought reliability, but I guess I'm. As we look at the risk assessment, I'm curious as to the nature of that effort. Are we going to look at individual pieces of the system to see what is the most risky part of this unusual kind of sanitary sewer, and can we start a series of improvements that are going to get this out of the lake?
Well, that's the way we would try to approach this. I think the last two leaks that we've had, or three breaches that we've had, were all inflow,
right.
And they were all these laterals that are above the edge of the
right.
lake. So I think that would be the first thing we would want to approach to secure those. We haven't ever had, I believe, a breach into the actual interceptor that's buried in the bottom of the lake, the main pipeline. So we would look at phasing this and the potential for not just those laterals to continue to leak, but also something that could happen, a major slide under the lake that would affect the interceptor, and that would be the sort of the catastrophic event that we would have.
How about inflow so catastrophic as to overwhelm the capacity of the plant?
We can control that portion of it. Yeah, that part we control. We have some consistency issues with some pumps that we put in that can provide more pump than the plant can treat, but we can control that part of the issue. It's the under the lake part that is the most difficult, because we can't get there, we can't see it. We basically have to respond and react to portions of isolating elements that we know about under
okay.
the lake.
And are we in a position where we would be able to actually start some physical improvements the next time we're at lowest water?
Yes.
By this time next year?
We would hope to be there, depending on the lake level.
Okay. Thank you.
Chairman Hill, members of the board, Pablo Ogren, Public Works Director. I just wanted to add a little bit because we have analyzed within the past decade this issue about whether or not that interceptor line should be taken out of the lake. Because on the one hand, it seems like obvious you want to get the pipeline out of the lake. But the work that was done in the earlier, about a decade ago when Dean's predecessor was on board, that risk assessment actually led to the conclusion that taking the pipe out of the lake and having more pumping stations would actually increase the risk of a sewer overflow out of manholes and because of pumping stations and into the lake. And so this risk assessment isn't presuming that we want to take the pipe out of the lake, but instead we'll have to look at options like do we want to encase that pipe, perhaps encasing it in concrete in order to provide more protective measures in the lake may be approach that's more appropriate. And so I just wanted to make sure to reflect on some of the historical analysis that has been done.
Mr. Meacham?
Thanks, and I appreciate Mr. Gibson's concern over, I can't even pronounce the word that you used. Catastrophized.
Oh, made-up word, perhaps. I'll
I
leave
thought
it
you
to
did.
The professor. Yeah.
But I'm also curious as to what are we doing or are we requiring from folks that are new projects that are coming on, that may be coming on board in the future in that area, to minimize whatever the risk will be later on?
I'm glad you asked that question. We have a track 2162 that has been on hold for a while. I think it's upwards of about 260 units or so, and initially they submitted to connect to the interceptor. We have required them to redesign that. This was a couple of years ago at this point. Redesign that so all of that water is conveyed to above lake systems that would not end up in the interceptor system itself. So that was a stance that we took, that nobody else will connect into that other than we have one or two house connections, but anything larger would have to require a separate system to get it to the wastewater plant.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'll open it up to the public, and I have no request to speak on this item for the public, so I'll bring it back to the board. And Mr. Meacham?
If I see no other lights on, I will move staff's recommendation. I don't know that there's any more direction that's needed at this point. I think we know what we need to do and to try to minimize the risk.
Okay.
I'll second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Meacham, second by Supervisor Patterson. There's no further discussion. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes.
And Mr. Hill.
Yes, thank you. And that brings us to closed session. I will open up to the public. I have no request to speak on closed session, so I'll close it and go to Mr. Jensen for a time estimate, please.
20 to 30 minutes.
Okay, 20 minutes. We will recess until 1:30, and we'll see you back then. Thank you. What?
Your microphones are live.
All right. Good afternoon, and thank you for being with us. We see some friendly faces on various presentations, but before we get to that, let me go to our county council for a report out of closed session. Mr. Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board met in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Okay, thank you. Motion?
So moved.
Second.
All right. The motion to approve the presentation calendar by Supervisor Meacham, seconded by Supervisor Gibson. Roll call, Madam Clerk, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes. Okay, we have two good presentations to make. The first will be to proclaim November National Adoption Month. And if Tracy Buckingham, our deputy department head of our social services, would come forward, and Supervisor Teixeira will be happy to read the resolution, and then we'll let you guys say a few words. Mr. Teixeira?
Thank you, Chairman Hill. This is a resolution proclaiming November as National Adoption Month in San Luis Obispo County. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas the County of San Luis Obispo recognizes the importance of giving children permanent, safe, and loving families through adoption, and whereas more than 127,000 children in the United States foster care system are waiting to be adopted, and whereas more than 19,000 children in California are waiting for permanent families, and whereas more than 100 children in San Luis Obispo County are waiting for permanent families, and whereas to help these children find permanent, nurturing families, the San Luis Obispo County Department of Social Services is acknowledging National Adoption Month to raise awareness for the need of adoptive families for local children and join other organizations to celebrate adoption and the families in their community. And whereas this effort, along with similar celebrations in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, will offer children the chance to live with stable and loving families and encourage other dedicated individuals to make a powerful difference in the lives of a child through adoption. Now, therefore, it be resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim November as National Adoption Month in San Luis Obispo County, and in doing so, urge all citizens to join in a national effort to raise awareness about the importance of adoption.
I also want to present you with our right off the presses today, 2012 youth calendar.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This was actually created by youth, and it is about our youth.
Good deal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to thank you and take this opportunity to recognize our adoption community. They're a shy group. And so I will ask them to stand as I mention where they're from. Would our social services staff, that's all of our social workers, our managers, our support staff, please stand. I am not sure if we have probation staff here. Probation?
Any probation staff want to stand?
I do want to mention that probation is an incredible partner with us in serving the youth in this community, and they actually finalized their first adoption. They're only one of three in the state where probation has done the adoption, so that's been really wonderful, and I'm sure there will be more to come. Family Care Network? Espiranet? Kinship Center, Family Connections, CASA, we'll clap. Cuesta College, we have two programs of Cuesta College, the Independent Living Program and the FKCE Program. See, she's shy. And County Council, who without them we wouldn't be able to finalize these. And then
Of course, the reason we all come to work in the morning and are able to accomplish this, our foster parents, our adoptive parents, and our adopted children. Do you have any with us? Again, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we really do appreciate all of you for all the work you do on behalf of children in our community and helping to provide them with the care and love of home and all the services. So thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. We are moving on to yet another inspiring presentation, Thank a Vet Month, which before I turn it over to my colleague, our resident veteran, Mr. Meacham, a Navy veteran, and ask our Veteran Services Officer, Dana Cummings, to come to the... I want to point out Greg Shearer, who has been the person who helped to start this year. This now, I assume, will be a continuing tradition at the Board of Supervisors to make November a Thank a Vet month. And Greg, as many people know, is a tireless advocate for veterans in our community, and we salute him. So before that, why don't we have our veteran, Mr. Meacham, read the proclamation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my privilege and my honor to do so. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas the people of the County of San Luis Obispo have great admiration and the utmost gratitude for all the men and women who have selflessly served their country and this community in the armed forces in order to protect and preserve the freedoms enjoyed by our citizens and all Americans, and the contributions and sacrifices of the more than 26,000 men and women living in San Luis Obispo County who served in the armed forces have been vital in maintaining the freedoms and way of life enjoyed by our citizens and others around the world. And whereas California Military and Veterans Code Sections 1365 designates the second full week in November as Veterans Appreciation Week, and whereas during Thank a Veteran Month, all levels of government and private citizens come together to honor and recognize our veterans for the great sacrifice they have made defending freedom and pay deep respect for those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim November 2011 as Thank a Veteran Month in San Luis Obispo County, urging all citizens and government leaders to honor the sacrifices made by our veterans and their families and pay homage to the men and women who have given their lives defending freedom and preserving our way of life.
Dana, do you want to get a quick photo here in front, and then we'll turn the lectern over to you, and you can... Yeah.
You're wearing good navy blue, buddy.
It's easier to see that way.
That's marine blue.
All right. We'll turn it over to you, Dana.
Supervisors, my fellow veterans, community members, everyone, thank you so much. As we proclaim November as Thank a Veteran Month, I want to start by thanking all the veterans we have in the audience today. If you guys could all stand up, everyone that's a veteran, be recognized for your service. As many of us take part in events to celebrate the sacrifices of our local veterans in the coming month, please don't forget to thank the veterans who still serve our community and our nation. It's the teacher that teaches your child. Thank him. It's the police officer who keeps you safe. Thank her. It's one of our board supervisors. Thank him. And please don't forget all those who need our help. Thank them by being there for them, our homeless vets, our disabled veterans. We all interact with veterans in our community. Some have been injured. Some continue to serve. Be grateful for their sacrifice. It's because of them we have our freedoms, and we owe them a great debt of gratitude. Thank you.
I had a couple of other people who wanted to speak, too. Robert Tolan, if you would, please, and then Mark Schaefer would like to speak as well. So, and Greg will go after that.
Thank you for seeing me. My name is Robert Tolan, and I am with Welcome Home Troops. We go around to the airports, to the train stations. We welcome home our vets as they're coming in. We thank them for their service, and we usually have anywhere from a crowd of 25 to the last one we had over 400 people. This is something that's open to the public. We ask for everyone that can show up. We hand out flags to everybody, and a lot of times the American Patriot Guard and American Legion Guards will escort the veterans to their homes. So I just wanted to invite all of you and all of you out here in the audience to join us at some time and come on out. We do have one tonight at the train station at 8:30. We usually meet a half hour beforehand. The veteran we have coming in today has been wounded 3 separate times, and he is coming home after 4 years of service. And he's coming directly from Afghanistan, so we'd like to have you there. Thank you.
Robert, if I could, yes. and thank you so much for this important work of welcoming our veterans, especially our wounded veterans. Is there a way for the public to find out about these events? Is there a website?
There is. We have a website. It's www.welcomehometroops.info.
Okay.
And you can go on there. We always have the information of upcoming events that are going on, and we also put on stuff about the past stuff that we've done. Whatever the most recent things are, we have a lot of photos on there for people to go on, and you can see everything that's happening with us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mark?
Good afternoon. Mark Schaefer. I'm the Executive Director of Ride On Transportation, and just wanted to take this opportunity to get you up to speed on the Veterans Express. Our ridership has almost doubled in the last year, and it's being used a great deal, and we're working with the VA to have them also supplement our program by donating several vans and setting up a volunteer coordinator that would be in the ride-on office. So we work side by side with volunteer drivers. They don't have to be veterans, but a lot of them are. And so we're hoping to double the number of riders again in the next year, but not have the additional costs that we have in our current system. So it's very exciting. It's getting used a great deal. And Greg's going to speak here in a second about one fundraiser we're doing. But we also have our annual Thank a Vet, where there's locations throughout the community that you can make a $5 donation and get a Thank a Vet wristband. And they're free for veterans, and they're red, white, and blue striped. So if you see a veteran with a red, white, and blue striped wristband, make sure that you thank them for their service. And you can check out the locations at our website, www.ride-on.org. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. And Greg.
Hi, my name is Greg Shear, and I'm very honored to be in front of you all. Veterans Express has been about a 5-6 year project, and we're making great strides, and we're blessed to be in this community where people do care about our veterans, and they show it in various ways. And one of the things that I've been blessed is in my involvement with the Veterans Express, I've come across some wonderful other organizations that people don't know anything about, and Robert's being one of them. And to go out and see these troops coming home, you know, I was out at the airport, and it was heart-wrenching, and it's just terrific to see how wonderful San Luis Obispo is supporting our troops and our veterans. With that said, I've got a fundraiser, and I do kind of off-the-wall stuff usually, and I'm having on November 19th a Texas Hold'em poker tournament. and I welcome all of you. If you don't know how to play, learn. Come sit and join.
Sit with
us and play some fun poker, and we're going to raise some good money for a good cause. And I can't announce it today, but I'm this close to announcing a major involvement into my poker tournament. But it'll be November 19th at 12 o'clock check-in at Mr. Rick's in Avila Beach downstairs.
Right.
And I'd like to eliminate all of you on the table.
For a good cause.
With that said, thank you. All of you so very much. I appreciate everything that you've done for me and the veterans throughout the county.
Thank you.
Greg, Supervisor Patterson.
Yeah, just a quick question. You might just briefly explain what Veterans Express is. People may not be familiar with that, so if you could do that.
Good question. Yeah, Veterans Express is something that I came across in, I think, 2005, visiting our VA clinic when I found out that we have many, many veterans in this county that have medical issues but are unable to make their appointments. And when I heard that, I was kind of astounded, and I immediately went over to Veterans Services, and I confronted the officer there. And he said, that's pretty much how it is. And I said, God, this has got to change. And so I started coming up with some weird ideas and how to raise some money and buy my own van and get some volunteers. And in the middle of that process, Mark stepped forward and saved my bacon. And we started in October of 2007. We were providing transportation for 10 to 12 veterans a month. In 2008, it grew to 40. And today, Mark, if I'm not mistaken, we're over 200. Over 200 a month. And that's 200 veterans getting health care that normally wouldn't be getting it. And it's something. It's in my blood and excites me to help out any way I can.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. All right. So always a great way to start off our afternoon, and thank all of those folks on one side of the room who are great helpers and advocates for children, and, of course, those over here who are veterans and doing great work on behalf of veterans. So thank you so much. You're always welcome to stay, but we wouldn't want to put you through that ordeal. Thank you for being here. We'll move on to our board business, which is always less inspirational, but okay. Yes. Madam Clerk, as soon as everybody files out, we can introduce our first item, if you would, please. I see our staff in place.
So your board's next item is E1, consideration of a request to authorize processing of the San Miguel Community Plan update, including amendments to the Salinas River Area Plan and the official maps of the county land use and circulation element, and the community planning standards for the San Miguel in Article 9 of the County Land Use Ordinance, 1st District.
Thank you. I see Mr. Stevenson, our long-range thinker.
Thank you, Chairman Hill, and we hope this is a little bit inspiring for you this afternoon after that fantastic presentation. We're here today requesting your board's authorization for a general plan update for the community of San Miguel. This is the first step in the process, although we have had considerable communication and work with the community, and I'll turn the presentation over to Michael Conger in just a moment, but I did want to provide just a few comments of context for you. We have discussed this plan with your board earlier this year at one of your strategic planning sessions in May, and later your board in June, on June 9th, acknowledged the great work at Cal Poly fourth-year students did in preparing an administrative draft. We waited this long to come to your board because we were waiting for receipt of an agreement from the State Strategic Growth Council on grant funding to help pay for a substantial portion of this project. And we received that. We brought it to your board last week, and your board approved that budget augmentation. So we're prepared now to move ahead. I also wanted to just take a moment to introduce you. You know Michael Conger, but Michael's been reassigned over into long-range planning from his prior position in current planning. We're really happy to have him on board. He will be the primary project manager on this project. We'll be working also with Mike Wolkin and Jay Johnson, but we'll be looking to Michael to kind of lead the effort. So I wanted just to introduce him to you today. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Conger.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Hill and members of the board. Michael Conger, County Planning Staff.
Good to see you, Michael.
Thank you. As Mr. Stevenson mentioned, this is a General Plan and Land Use Ordinance Amendment Authorization. Just a little bit of background on community planning in San Miguel. The original plan was adopted in 1981 as part of the Salinas River Area Plan. That plan was comprehensively updated in 1996. community design guidelines were adopted in 2003, and then there were some minor zoning revisions in 2007. The community of San Miguel is a relatively unique community. It has a tremendous historic value, both from prehistoric times, it was inhabited by the Salinan people, and also through other facilities such as the Mission and Adobe. And there's also a lot of history surrounding Camp Roberts. In 1940s, when the Second World War was starting to gear up, Camp Roberts brought a ton of people in through San Miguel as it became a boom town. San Miguel also has a central business district that is relatively well-defined, and it's a walkable business district. And their community has a tremendous sense of pride. There's a lot of people in San Miguel who feel very connected to their community, and they have organizations such as the Resource Connection and the Advisory Council that are there to ensure that their community is improving and that sort of thing. And in fact, at the last Advisory Council meeting, it was mentioned that a Chamber of Commerce is going to be forming there as well. So that will be a great opportunity to work with them in terms of economic strategies. So the question is, why would we be looking at San Miguel, particularly because this is not a project that is on the board's priority list at this time? We have a few answers to that. The first is that the board and the community have both expressed interest in doing a community plan update for San Miguel in the recent past. A second is that we've been able to reduce costs by collaborating with Cal Poly and obtaining some grant funding. And third is that San Miguel presents an opportunity for implementation of strategic growth principles. So in terms of the interest, back in 2009, your board considered a project called the San Miguel Ranch General Plan Amendment. That project was a relatively large project. It would have expanded the town to the north and the west towards Camp Roberts. And when that project was going through the process, it actually started dialogue amongst the people of San Miguel as to how they want to see their community grow. In the end, the project was denied by the Board of Supervisors, and at that time, there was an expressed interest in doing a more comprehensive update for San Miguel to plan its growth well into the future, and the community generally concurs with that as well. So with our funding and collaboration, we started a partnership with Cal Poly. We've done this many times before, but this will be the first time where we're actually taking the work the students have done and using that as the base for our plan. The students have prepared an administrative draft plan, which is something that we'd normally have a consultant do, and so we're saving substantial costs that way. Additionally, the students took it upon themselves to really go forward with community outreach. They held a number of workshops. They went to the schools and talked to students. They went to Spanish-speaking organizations to make sure that those communities were represented as well. So they had a very engaging community outreach program, and that's something that we'll definitely benefit from. In terms of the grant financing, your board approved last week a total package that would have been $399,000. Of that, $129,000 is earmarked for technical studies in support of the San Miguel Community Plan update, and those studies are regarding traffic, water, economic strategies, and infrastructure financing. So the benefits of this approach are that we've saved substantial cost. We're saving time because we're able to undertake this plan earlier than we would be if we had to wait for funding for consultants and that sort of thing. And we're going to be increasing community outreach efforts by, first of all, having the students upfront a lot of that work by conducting those workshops and getting a collaborative approach to the policies. And then we'll also be doing that once a draft plan is released to the public. Some opportunities for strategic growth in San Miguel. It's located along Highway 101, which, of course, is a primary north-south thoroughfare in the state, connecting the L.A. region with the Bay Area. And it's the northern gateway to San Luis Obispo County. As I mentioned, because it's a relatively small community, it's well adaptable to walking and biking. Most of the residences in San Miguel are within a mile distance of the Central Business District, and that Central Business District has bars, restaurants, shops, a market, bus stop, post office, various facilities that people wouldn't need to get in their cars to use. Additionally, San Miguel has a number of vacant and underutilized parcels, so we've found just through our conceptual processing that most of San Miguel's growth can be accommodated in the existing town without expanding the town substantially. The community itself has a desire for more retail and service commercial uses. tourism is a big opportunity in San Miguel because it does have so many historic resources, and in fact, that was something that the EDC identified in the economic strategy as an opportunity sector. So we would be looking at what we can do to increase tourism in San Miguel. Right now, the land in San Miguel is relatively affordable, and developers have looked at it as a future growth area. So we see this being as a likely progression of growth is additional growth in San Miguel. Staff anticipates that an environmental impact report will need to be prepared in order to approve the community plan. And so at this time, we're proposing that staff prepare the environmental impact report in-house. We've budgeted for staff to complete that task. There are other options. One would be consultant preparation of the environmental impact report, which would be an added cost of about $190,000. And then there's a hybrid option, which would involve using a consultant for certain parts, but doing the bulk of the work in-house, and that would cost an estimated $50,000. So the process, as Mr. Stevenson alluded to at the beginning, is that in order to move forward with a general plan amendment, first, your board must authorize staff to process that. And once that authorization occurs, we will be preparing the public review draft and public hearing drafts of the plan, and we will be doing the environmental impact report. When those are ready, a planning commission hearing will be held, and the planning commission will make a recommendation to your board, and the final decision is ultimately up to your board in terms of whether or not to certify the environmental impact report and adopt the community plan. And actually, because of the involvement of Cal Poly, we've had a few tasks done up front. And so Cal Poly's done a lot of background research, as we mentioned. They've done a bunch of community outreach, and they've prepared an administrative draft plan. Typically, we wouldn't have those steps done at this point in the process. So this is a little sneak preview from what the students have synthesized from the community's comments. And so this is the vision statement that they came up with. San Miguel will build upon its rich historic resources while becoming a vibrant and prosperous community for both residents and visitors. San Miguel will become a community which balances local, social, and economic needs while providing public facilities, increased connectivity, and encourage sustainable, low-impact development and resource conservation. And the community has also identified a number of objectives. And I won't read through all of these, but some of the interesting ones would include harmonizing new development with the existing development and revitalizing some of the older development, focusing on a community priority such as developing the local economy and bringing in job-creating businesses and expanding on tourism. Keep San Miguel safe and healthy, promote community identity, protect natural resources. These are just a few of the objectives that were identified. As far as our work program goes, these are a few of the milestones that we anticipate hitting. In June, we plan to release the public review draft plan, which will be the first public document that goes out for comment. And at the same time, we'll start doing additional public outreach to try to find out what needs to be revised in that plan. The following summer, we'll look to put out the draft environmental impact report and the public hearing draft plan that contains those revisions, and begin the planning commission hearings in summer of 2013 and the board of supervisor hearings in early 2014 with final plan adoption around March 2014. So staff's recommendation is that your board review the work outline, consider the options provided, and determine whether or not to authorize the San Miguel Community Plan update for processing. If your board does choose to authorize the plan for processing, we would also recommend that you direct staff to proceed with the technical studies using the strategic growth grant funding that was obtained last week once the state authorizes us to proceed on that. And that concludes our presentation.
Okay, very good, Michael. Let me see questions or comments from my colleagues and the man from District 1.
I just have one quick comment. Michael, weren't you part of Cal Poly when they did the first design thing?
Yeah, I was a student at Cal Poly. Winter of 2003, 2004, we did a project very similar to this.
That's just what I thought.
That's good. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Conger, relative to Cal Poly's involvement in this process, you spoke about a rather robust community outreach process that they engaged in. Was that a city and regional planning class project, and how long did that go on, and is it still underway?
It was a class project that started in fall quarter of last year, I believe. Does that sound right? So they would have started in September of 2010 and completed their work around spring of 2011.
I see. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, just quickly, too. Mr. Conger, I would assume that we're going to be able to integrate some of the other studies that are underway currently. I know right now there's an application in for a park grant, and there's been a lot of discussion about a design for the park expansion. And we also are kicking off the joint land use study with Camp Roberts, I believe. That's beginning fairly soon. And I know that the Gateway project that we've been talking about for some time, that now is looking pretty positive as well. So I would assume that in discussion with the Cal Poly folks and as we go forward with this, if we do, that these will be integrated into that discussion.
My understanding with the JLUS is that its primary focus is on the lands immediately around Camp Roberts, so we don't anticipate too much overlap between the JLUS plan and the community plan, but we're going to take a look at both of them to make sure that there's no conflicts or anything of that nature. We've been looking at other opportunities to combine resources. Actually, the San Miguel Ranch project has an environmental impact report, and they did a tremendous amount of technical study and review, so we don't need to reinvent the wheel on a lot of that stuff. It just needs to get updated based on the existing information. So we're going to look for all opportunities we can to try to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions from the board, so I'll open it up to the public. And I have no request to speak on this item, and I see no one coming forward. And actually, I see someone wanting to come forward, so why don't you please come forward, state your name. We'll have you fill out a form before you leave, if you could, please.
Thank you, Board. My name is Anthony Calvins. I serve on the San Miguel Advisory Council. I am not speaking on behalf of the Advisory Council, but for my own personal opinion, as I've lived in the town my entire life, I support the amendments to San Miguel. A lot of the community people, I've spoken with lots of business leaders, they're excited. They want to build off of what we have. We have a great tourism, as Mr. Conger has outlaid for our town. And the town is ready to grow, ready to become the gateway. We want to become a shining example. We have a lot of good use because most people live within the town, 1 mile of the central business district. So walkable community, we can be a shining example of what other communities can follow. And I would ask the board to support the authorization as Mr. Conger has outlined for the board today. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And that will close it to the public. And if we could just get you to fill out one of those slips right there for the clerk, that would be kind of you. I'll go back to Mr. Meacham.
With no further discussion, I'm going to make a motion. But I want to clarify something, too, because I know last week in our discussion about things, I did not vote for this strategic growth grant. And I think I laid out my reasons for it, but I want to reiterate, I'm anxious to see where this goes because a lot of the discussion has been focused on infill and density. And obviously there's a lot of other things that goes along with that. And that's what typically turns off some of these communities. When they hear those terms, they lose sight of the other things that might be accomplished. So however we proceed through this, I think it's absolutely essential that the other things are clarified, not just the infill aspect of it and the density of these things. So with that, I would move staff's recommendation.
And I'll second. I have a comment.
Okay, Mr. Patterson?
Yes, I think it's incumbent on us to really educate the public about what strategic growth and smart growth is. And words like density does scare people, but what are the alternatives to density? And we need to speak about that as well. And we've heard from one community advisory committee member about how excited the San Miguel community is to move forward with this process and speaking about the improved business district and the walkability and those kinds of elements that are all part of strategic growth, and I think we need to really emphasize that this is precisely what we want to be doing for the many reasons that Mr. Conger addressed in his presentation. This can be a shining example to other communities in San Luis Obispo County as to how we can grow appropriately, protecting our rural ag land and open space and providing great opportunities for people to live in rural communities.
Okay.
To clarify the motion, then you are authorizing the processing. Thank you.
That's correct. Second by Mr. Patterson. I would agree, and maybe instead of saying density or infill, we just say, you know, sidewalks, parks, vibrant downtowns, the things that we all like. That
bars and restaurants.
Done well.
Houses that people can afford.
Yes. Houses that people can afford, all that good stuff. So with that, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham.
And before I go, I want to compliment Michael on your presentation up in San Miguel, as well as when we had the community outreach and you were there to interact with a lot of the citizens up there. They appreciated your historic presence, even though you're not that historical in terms of age. But I greatly appreciate your outreach with that. Aye.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. DeShera.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you Mr. Conger. We will move on then to our DANA item, as I see various staff folks swapping in and out of place. Madam Clerk, could you introduce this item, please?
Certainly. That would be item E2, consideration of an authorization to process a land use ordinance amendment application by Dana Adobe Napomo Amigos to change sections of the South County Inland Planning Area Standards on a 29-acre parcel to facilitate a proposal for a new museum focusing on the cultural and natural resources of the Napomo Creek watershed and the Napomo Mesa, located at 671 South Oakland Avenue in the community of Napomo, 4th District.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Hogue, how are you?
I'm fine. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Board. What we're considering today is the first step in the land use ordinance amendment process. It's an initial review by your board to decide whether you want to authorize this application for processing or not. And Brian Pedrotti will describe the specific request and answer any questions that you may have about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Brian?
Good afternoon, Chairperson Hill and Board of Supervisors. Brian Pedrotti, staff planner. The project before you is the authorizing of the processing of a land use ordinance amendment application to amend sections of the South County Planning Area Standards. And the goal is to facilitate a new museum focusing on cultural and natural resources in the Napomo area. The site is currently developed with the historic Dana Adobe and supporting amenities such as a caretaker unit and parking, driveway, landscaping areas. The Dana Adobe is a California State Historical Landmark. It's listed on the National Register of Historical Places, and they're currently applying for a national landmark status. The proposed project includes the new visitors center, museum, a Chumash Village replication, trail system, restoration areas, and picnic areas, as well as other amenities to go along with those. The project's located at 671 South Oakland Avenue in the community of Napomo. It's within the recreation land use category, and it's surrounded by agricultural land use category to the northeast and west, and residential suburban to the northwest, and it is within the Napomo Urban Reserve line. It's just an aerial of the site at the southwest corner of the community of Napomo. The site itself and the change that's proposed for the planning area standards is really focused on the 29-30 acre Dana Adobe site, which is outlined in yellow. Portion of the project that will be coming in under a conditional use permit that includes a trail system includes the larger property to the east. The standards that are currently within our planning area standards were established in 1996, and they are concerned with the Dana Adobe development relating to the South Oakland Avenue as a long dead-end road. It identified the Highway 101 Southland Interchange as a solution to this long dead-end road. And they also established and provided standards for the historic nature of the Dana Adobe with the land use compatibility standards. The current standards limit the uses on the site to residential suburban, even though the land use category is recreation, and the uses would expand to the recreation land use category upon construction of a Highway 101 Southland interchange. The proposed museum use currently is not allowed under the current standard. Therefore, the applicant has proposed a number of changes to those planning area standards. The first one is regarding the combining designation for the historic area of the Dana Adobe. And really, this just is a simplified standard with a deleted sentence, and really it refers back to the section stated here, 22.112.080G, which are the detailed standards for the Dana Adobe site. And so that section is the kind of the meat of the changes, and it includes replacing the requirement for a Southland Street interchange with an emergency access or safe refuge. It updates the master plan and future development requirements, and then it updates the development compatibility requirements. Further, there's a section that's proposed for change, which is the Napomo Mesa Water Conservation Area, otherwise known as Ordinance 3090. This ordinance requires supplemental water for general plan amendments when they exceed existing water demand, and the proposed change is to, at least initially, is to exclude the property from these standards, and the applicant is currently working on other options, including attempting to create no net change in the amount of water used on the site today. And so and the applicant is here and can speak to that if necessary. The authority for a land use ordinance amendment is in the framework for planning. It includes a consideration of the surroundings, the residential design, and safe circulation. And in general response, staff will be considering the aesthetics and visual resources and the land use section of the initial study per CEQA for incompatibilities in the consideration of the surroundings. As far as residential design, there is no residential component except for the caretaker unit. And then for safe circulation, there will be a traffic study prepared for the project, which will be reviewed by County Public Works and Caltrans, and any requirements and mitigations will need to be incorporated into the project. So your two options are to authorize processing or do not authorize processing. And that concludes staff's presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. Questions from the board? I don't see yet, so we'll go to the public. Slips, I know that there are slips waiting, Ms. DeLeo and Mr. Nguyen, so why don't you take whoever gets to the microphone first can go first. I see her running. Okay.
Oh, he's being polite and letting me go. My name is Jan DeLeo, and I'm actually staff of the Dana Adobe. And I think as some of you realize, about a year and a half ago, well, actually last April of 2011, we got a grant for almost $3 million to build this visitor center and build all sorts of sorts of educational facilities out at the Dana Adobe. The way the ordinance reads right now, we would not be able to build that visitor center, and that's the reason for the request for the LUO text amendment. We are under a pretty quick timeline for processing, and I would especially like to thank Brian for all his help, and county planning staff have just been great. I really don't have anything to add other than we hope you will support the initiation, and if you have any questions, I'm available.
Thank you, Jan. Good to see you. Mike?
Good afternoon again, gentlemen. It's nice to see Ms. DeLeo back again, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Dan Adobe obviously is one of the most important things in all of Napomo. It's the core of our identity. It's where we began as a community. And it's essential that this be approved and that we get this done within their funding period. It's also essential that we don't undermine our water supply in the process. And we think in the district that we have two possibilities for you, either one of which could solve the problem. You might like them both. So here we go. First, we're not convinced that this requires a general plan amendment. The general plan says that this cannot be built until you have an exchange, an interchange at Southland. But the underlying message of that is that you have to have a second way out. You have to have an emergency exit. That was the purpose of Southland. There was no linkage of Southland per se with the Adobe, other than the fact that that seemed to be the obvious way of getting out in case there was a fire. The Adobe folks have identified yet another way out to go across the creek. It'll take some time and effort, but we would be very supportive in that. And they could go on up to South Thompson, which was the original entrance to the Adobe anyway. And in doing so, you would not have to change the zoning. It would still say recreation. You would not have the limitations on it because you had a second way out. They could go ahead and build what they need to build without a general plan amendment. That's our argument. Your staff may disagree, and they're better trained than I am. So I will move on to my second point. In the district, we do not believe that this project will require, in its first phase, more non-agricultural water than what they're currently entitled to. Currently, they have a one-inch line that comes down the road. We serve them as an outside user in the NCSD. They're not in the district, but they're in our sphere of influence. A one-inch line will serve everything that the new center requires, I believe. You can check with their engineers, with the sole exception of fire flow for sprinklers. But for that, they'll have to put a 6-inch line down the middle of the road, but the 6-inch line does not go through the meter. It's not part of their capacity holdings. In other words, it continues to be a 1-inch connection from the district's perspective, and we don't believe that they'll need more than that. Now, if they aren't sure whether some other aspect of the general of their master plan would require a bit more, they could add a condition saying they would not go beyond what a 1-inch line would serve until we have supplemental water. And to us, that would be perfectly acceptable. So we do not want you to make an exception to your ordinance 3090. It's very important to us, and we hope that you'll defend it. Thank you.
Mike, if I could, just to clarify here, and I think so you're saying that you can support the staff recommendation, or?
We support the staff recommendation, except for the phrase that says, making an exception to the Napomo Mesa Water Conservation Area.
Okay.
We're all in the same boat. We all have the same water supply.
Mr. Gibson, do you have a question for Mr.
Wynn? Well, I would surmise that the details of how the LUO is going to be reworded are part of the process we're about to embark on, so that conversation can continue. And it would seem logical, if I remember correctly, that while zoned rec, it is allowed any residential suburban use, which would be a primary residence and a secondary, and we could figure out what the use is of that relative to the potential of a visitor center and decide whether we need whether we need that language or not. But that's all part of what we're trying
what
to
we're
get going
be headed
here.
Towards, yeah.
And we concur with the Supervisor Gibson. We just wouldn't like you to say we're going to make an exception today. Give us time to work this out. I'm confident that with the Adobe folk, we'll be able to do that in the time that's allowed. We can do it quickly, too.
Okay. And Mr. Wynn, you did mention the fire flow requirement. They would still be connected to your system, and you would provide that in an emergency, but it would just be under those terms.
Absolutely. But we don't have capacity charges for sprinkler systems.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Mr. Teixeira, would you like to put your mic on,
microphone?
Please?
Move to take staff's recommendation with the exception discussed by Supervisor Gibson.
Okay.
I'll
I'll second.
And clarify?
I'll second, understanding that you're moving to authorize the processing of this general plan amendment.
Thank
and
you.
Observing to staff that we're not directing them as to language regarding 3090.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can I just ask for a clarification?
Yes, please.
I'm McNulty with the County Council. Yep. You're not excluding that review of whether or not an amendment
Correct.
To 3090 is necessary
Correct.
In order to accomplish this, right?
Right.
Right. We're not excluding.
Making it clear that the suggested language is not necessary. I mean, not necessarily the final language. We'll find out as we go through the
process. But it's within the scope of things that staff can look at and try to figure out whether or not it needs to
and
happen.
Study.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Thank you.
This won't hold anything up, will it?
Doubtful.
Shouldn't. Okay.
Mr. Wynn, did you want to make a quick reappearance here so we can avoid any NCSD tangling?
As much as I hate to disagree with learned counsel, you folks know that in the real world, the authorization vote is the only one that's voluntary. When it comes to the second phase, it's pretty much a rubber stamp with everything else that's in the hopper. So to leave the alteration of 3090 in there as a possibility for us creates a huge problem. And we can't wait until the end to make noise about it. And we don't want to stop this project. Okay. So that would be an impediment for us. We would like for it to go quickly.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, if I might, I don't see that this authorization, the language regarding 3090 is only in there as a suggestion or a possibility. Being sensitive to the issues of water on the mesa, it is by no means the case that we're looking at the final land use ordinance amendment before us, and we're gonna direct staff, and as part of this, we'll direct staff to work with the CSD to make sure we come to an amenable resolution of that.
I know we can resolve this.
Good,
Mr. Leo, did you want to make a final comment on this?
Just for clarification, we are supposed to go back to the NCSD board. We have given them some preliminary water data, which may mean an amendment to 3090 is not necessary, but we don't know that yet. We have not gone back to the full NCSD board. So I would like that to stay as an option, and it would be discussed in the CEQA document as well if we pursue that language, but I would like to maintain that option on the table and have time to work it through.
We can work it out, Mike.
But if that turns out to be the case, we will not supply water for this project.
Again, I'm confident we can work it out. We just take this as an expression of our board's sensitivity to the fact that we have water issues in the Pomo.
And we understand not only the water issues, but the appreciation from everyone in the community about the enormous historic and cultural resource that the Dana represents. Mr. Hogue?
I just wanted to emphasize for everyone's understanding that an authorization is not a guarantee that an amendment will be approved. And this is a package of amendments. There's several things involved. As staff does its review and performs in the environmental review, we'll determine really what is the right approach. And there's really, it's not set in stone that we would be recommending exclusion from 3090. There may be other ways to solve the problem, and we'll work further with all the parties involved, including council. So just to try to set Mr. Wynn's mind at ease, this is just a head nod to look at the issue. It doesn't mean that it's actually going to either be recommended or adopted by the board. I hope that helps.
Mm-hmm. That's the way I see it. Okay, so we have a motion on staff recommendation by Supervisor Teixeira and a second by Supervisor Gibson. With further discussion, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes, thank you. And we thank you, Mr. Leo and Mr. Wynn, for your help on this. And that will call it a day for us. We'll adjourn till next Tuesday. We'll see you bright and early at 9 a.m. Thank you.